From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South.
Not 10 minutes outside of town, a loud bang, and then a vibration came from the back of the car.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
My second option was a BB pistol that looked a lot like what I imagined a German Glock would look like.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
After walking down about two levels, the J. Edgar Hoover tick. No credentials. Check, 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 check. No creds.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Oh, well, knock three times, and if you don't hear a say, you'll know where to find me. It's one bar time, you'll know where to find me. It's one bar time.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's band, the Salty Dogs? What'd y'all think? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at their website, thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And what about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's stories are all about having a bad day, the kind of day where things go from bad to worse. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Philip Taylor's intentions are met, but then the ramifications set in. And we'll end the night losing something of great importance with Taylor Eubank. But let's start the night with Bruce Trice as his trip south to bury his grandmother gets off to a bad start. And that's just the beginning in Highway 165.
The faded red needle on the speedometer was resting firmly on 70 miles an hour as I navigated our family Suburban due east that afternoon, traveling Highway 165 toward the Arkansas Grand Prairie. How many times had I traveled that same 60 miles of blacktop in my 45 years? The highway stretched out in front of me, and I pressed on the accelerator. I was in a hurry today. I was always in a hurry. We were fighting the clock in an effort to hustle our five children, my wife and me, out the door and into the car for the one-hour journey to my grandmother Trice's funeral visitation. Just before leaving, our postman delivered a late notice on an unpaid bill, which was just enough to trigger a small war between my wife and me. After a few colorful minutes, one of us raised a white flag and we all piled into the SUV. Not 10 minutes outside of town, a loud bang, and then a vibration came from the back of the car, a blown tire. Not now, I grumbled. I took a deep and disgusted breath and pulled onto the shoulder of the road. Stepping out of the car, I immediately noticed a man who looked to be in his 50s walking toward me. He was smiling and from a short distance offered to help. I refused, civilly, and then he quietly sat down in the grass on the side of the road and started eating his lunch from a paper sack. I was already nervous about having to see my tiny, 5-foot-nothing, 100-pound grandmother, whom we all called Big, in a very large and cold casket. When we were all children, my cousin Gwen was the first to start calling her Big Mama, later shortened to just Big. Even my friends called her that. I knelt down on the pavement and got back to work, a stinking flat tire, I thought, and on top of that, a stranger was now watching my every move. A bead of sweat ran down my nose and dripped onto my necktie. Now we were late for sure. I did my southern best to politely ignore the man and change that flat tire like I was being timed in a NASCAR pit stop. Just minutes later, I clicked the buckle on my seatbelt and admitted out loud that I hadn't even asked this fella's name or what his circumstances were. My wife, smiling, suggested that the stranger on the highway might have been a guardian angel. I half grinned in partial agreement and gave the accelerator a push. The kids were chatting away in the back seats while my wife split her time between reading parts of a book and carefully applying her makeup. I was making mental notes, connecting to each town we encountered, just like I'd done for years on this road. We passed through Scott, and I admired the manicured fields just to the north. I'm certainly no farmer, but my grandfather, Papa Trice, was, and he taught me to see beauty in a simple plot of farmland. Next was Keogh, known for its notorious on and off speed trap over the years, Charlotte's Eats and Sweets, and a pretty pecan grove in the curve of the road. It was an off day for the speed trap, and the pecan trees were a reminder of my grandparents' values. They gathered pecans like they were gold nuggets and shared them with family, friends, and neighbors like little chunks of hospitality in a brown paper sack. England was in the distance, our halfway point, and I remembered going there with my dad one chilly Christmas Eve when I was 12 to pick up a new Buick Century at the local dealership. I'd never seen so much red vinyl in my whole life. I took another deep breath, remembered the smell, and felt my shoulders relax just a little bit. Just the other side of England, we rushed past the right turn to the community of Coy. Uncle Chester Ingram had been the song leader in the Church of Christ there for many years. I recently heard the church was gone, along with much of Coy, another little farm community that time had passed by. It had gotten quiet behind me. Glancing in the rearview mirror, I saw our son with his head tilted at an odd angle, fast asleep. The year before, he and I traveled this highway on our way to the World Championship Duck Calling Contest. It was a cloudy November day when we witnessed a massive flock of blackbirds rising slowly from a rice field. They were so thick that the sky looked like it had a giant, solid black ribbon in it, just floating, blowing up and down in the wind. Further east were the tiny communities of Allport, then Humnoak, where I spent the first 5 years of my life weaving my way around the aisles in Trice Brothers Grocery, my grandparents' general store. Just before I turned 6, my family moved 12 miles east to Stuttgart, but my grandparents remained there for many years. We made countless trips back and forth to this once thriving little hub for surrounding and much smaller farm communities. My very first Sunday school class was there in the First United Methodist Church, the very same church where Big's funeral would be held the following morning. The pews in the little wood-frame church would be packed. Big would be so proud that people decided to come to church, even if it was for her funeral. When I was a boy, sometimes I sat in the second pew back from the front, on the right side, with my grandparents. I loved sitting right next to Big and Papa, listening to them sing the old hymns. This particular seat also positioned me directly behind Mr. Charlie Calvert, who always wore a fedora, except in church, to cover up his bald head. While the preacher contrasted hellfire and damnation with the forgiveness of our sins and an everlasting life with Jesus, I would stare for whole minutes at the back of his head and wonder how in the world he made it shine like that. I slowed the SUV down in a forced reverence through the little town, past the empty lot where the old store once was, and just down the street from the little church. I could still hear them singing, "This is my Father's world." I saw ghosts in broad daylight. We sped on through the tiny settlements of G Ridge and then Brummett, where I quickly calculated that half of the then 20 or so residents were from the Frank Snyder family. Despite the day's events and my current high rate of speed, I felt a sudden strange calm wash over me, as if Highway 65 was comforting me like an old familiar friend. We were just a few miles from our destination when out of nowhere, blue lights lit up my rearview mirror. My heart started racing, and my newfound calmness evaporated like a gallon of milk in a house full of boys. Unbelievable, I said to my wife. Looking back in the mirror, the trooper was right on my tail. I quietly cursed, signaled, and pulled the car over to the shoulder again.
Digging in every pocket for my driver's license, I finally felt it inside my suit jacket. I pressed the button for my window to roll down while my wife performed a professional excavation of the glove compartment to extricate our registration and proof of insurance. I was speeding, no doubt, driving 75 in a 55, I confessed to the trooper in mirrored sunglasses. We were on our way to my grandmother's wake, and I'd had a flat, I explained. The evidence was in the back of the vehicle and still on my hands for his inspection. The trooper was merciful, and I thanked him profusely and rolled my window back up. I eased the car back onto the highway and shared a little bit of pro-eating wisdom with my very relieved family. Just when you think things are really bad, remember they can always get worse in a hurry. Then, giving my full attention to the road ahead, I noticed that we still had about 4 miles left to go.
Bruce Trice is a fourth-generation native of Arkansas County, resides in North Little Rock with his wife and children, and is Southern enough to know that a proper bottle tree keeps the haints away. In our next story, Philip Taylor decides to let off some steam, but his plan works a little too well in Glockenrobben.
I was 13 years old when I decided the only way to feel better about myself and blow off some steam the day before the start of my arbitrary eighth grade year was to take my frustrations out on a poor, defenseless creature whilst in the confines of my own backyard. I had two choices of firearms I could use to do my damage. The first was a Daisy BB gun that had seen better days. I think it had lost its ability to cause a bruise, let alone penetrate the skin, quite a few years before. My second option was a BB pistol that looked a lot like what I imagined a German Glock would look like. Having never actually seen a Glock, and only knowing of the word through rap songs, it was the closest I could imagine a Glock would look like. I had hunted several times before, actually in the deer woods, as my fellow Arkansans referred to the timber-drenched landscape of my homeland. But I had the pleasant misfortune of growing up with a father who had a severe hunting disability and that he could not track down an animal to save his life. Granted, it probably didn't help to have an immensely clumsy clod of a son dragging his sneakers through the fallen foliage. In retrospect, I am rather glad that my father was not a skilled hunter. It saved me the trouble of not throwing up in front of my countrified friends at the sight of blood, or the putrid smell of deer urine when some drunken hunter would tear into the scent sack while field dressing a deer. Unlike most people who hunt either for sport or to hear loud things go boom, this particular backyard hunting excursion was a result of one of my yearly back-to-school meltdowns, or BTSMs, as I later called them. As an overly emotional youth, I had difficulty coming to terms with the fact that I had to give up my summer of freedom and isolation to go back to school and be bullied by kids who were too dumb to do anything other than pick on the weak and defenseless. My lethal BB pistol had a long barrel with a shiny, sleek black gloss. It had been the unfortunate victim of shooting ants out of ant holes and was clogged with dirt most of the time. My BB Glock probably had less power than my Daisy rifle, but it made me feel like a middle-class, pasty white thug. After choosing my weapon, I draped the pistol next to my lanky frame and let it dangle from my hand like a man on a mission. I then proceeded to do the next thing a seasoned hunter would do, climb a tree. For a whippy sissy, I could climb the mess out of any tree in the area, and I once climbed a pine tree to at least 100 feet off the ground. Before I became stuck out of fear and was left to contemplate the meaning of life while dangling in the air, which in that moment was to not get killed from falling out of a pine tree. With it being late August and not many furry creatures stirring about in my backyard in the middle of town, I searched for a creature dumb enough to be outside on a 100-degree day, a bird. I scoured the yard for the first bird I could see, which was a robin. It was not just any ordinary robin, but a baby robin. In retrospect, hunting a baby bird ranks up there on the manly scale alongside with taking candy from babies and pushing little old ladies into oncoming traffic. Nevertheless, that bird was mine. Having missed a soda can from 10 yards just a few days earlier, I did not expect to hit anything within the immediate vicinity of my winged nemesis. Now, what happened next is a bit fuzzy. I remember pulling the trigger, a small creature making a thud as it hit the ground, and feeling nauseated from the late August heat. I still have no idea how I hit my target, but I think it had something to do with a crooked sight and actually aiming about a foot to the right, in which I nailed the beautiful songbird square in the head. My reaction was quite different from what you would expect a seasoned hunter to respond to. As soon as I saw the helpless creature lying on the ground, I felt a veil of sadness fold over me. I ran over to the baby robin whilst repeatedly chanting, "What did I do? What did I do? What did I do?" I thought that my savage hunter aim was enough to suffocate the life right out of the helpless, defenseless baby bird. When I approached the bird, I could tell that it was still very much alive, but appeared to be severely injured. I paused and thought, well, no duh, you did just shoot it out of a tree. Watching the dying little bird gasp for life made me instantly realize what had to be done. I had to put the baby bird out of its misery. I cocked my wannabe Glock and held it directly to the robin's head. I could see absolute fear in the bird's eye. Death was near. I sweated. I paused. I gasped. I took a deep breath and, thwomp, a BB dribbled out of the barrel, barely fast enough to be considered being shot out of a gun. The stunned bird looked at me with an expression of, "I'm alive," and, "What?" I cocked my fake German BB gun and held it to the little bird's head, and again, thwomp. Another little trickle of a tiny silver orb left the barrel and bounced off the baby bird's head. By this time, I was in a sure state of panic. I wanted the bird dead so I could dispose of the evidence and pretend this little episode never happened. Again and again and again, thwomp, thwomp, thwomp. I fired shot after shot into the head of the steel robin. Upon firing the fifth shot to the bird's head, it lifted its crippled wing up to me as if to say, "Help me, Philip, help me with all your might. Go and get the finest supplies that you can find for nursing me back to health. Go, dear Philip, go and nurse me back to health so I can sing you many a harmonious tune from high atop the highest tree. And I may thank you with my bellowing song that you nurse me back to health so I may spend one more day on this beautiful earth to welcome the shine of the sun and sleep in the glow of the moon." But in retrospect, the bird was probably just reaching out his wing to snatch the gun from me whilst thinking, "Here, give me that thing so I can finish the job myself, you coward." Instead, I took the outstretched wing as a sign to nurse my victim back to health. I ran inside and grabbed a Band-Aid, cotton balls, rubbing alcohol, medical tape, and Q-tips. I now assume that would have been a good arsenal of supplies if my little friend had fallen off his bike and hit a scraped knee or massive amount of earwax buildup. After 10 grueling minutes in the blistering heat, I had bandaged my feathered friend into what appeared to be an unraveled baseball with a beak. As I sat there with this atrocity of a creature in my sweaty palms, tears rolled down my puffy cheeks. I pointed the winged creature to the sky as if offering the bird as a sacrifice. I closed my eyes, clenched my teeth, and hoped for the best. I opened my hands and the little ball of Q-tip sticks and gauze flew over the fence. I watched as he landed and flopped a few feet at a time. By the time he tried his fifth and final turn at flight, he flew far enough to make it to the other side of my neighbor's shed and out of eyesight. This feat, nothing short of miraculous, washed my soul. Granted, The little mess of a bird probably didn't make it too much farther than my neighbor's shed, but I still felt like $1 million. I had gone from killer to savior, from the villain to the hero of the day. I stood up, brushed the dirt from the seat of my pants, and slowly sauntered my way through my little backyard on Robert E. Lee Street in Malvern, Arkansas, on that hot August afternoon.
Philip Taylor is an author, musician, and university instructor from Malvern, Arkansas. He recently published his first ebook novella, Running Insanity, and is working on a collection of essays and creative nonfiction. He currently resides in Searcy, Arkansas, with his wife, Leanne. In our final story of the night, Taylor Eubanks starts the day at a baseball game, but the fun stops there in Sherlock Holmes Shows Me.
After 27 years in the FBI, I offer an expert opinion. The world's best investigator in the mid-1990s, maybe ever, was a shoe clerk. In the world of investigative machismo, the term shoe clerk is pejorative. I don't mean it that way. The guy ran the shoe department at a Dillard's department store in St. Louis. He is my hero. We met at a Cardinals doubleheader. I have listened to the Cardinals broadcast since the early 1950s. I'm entitled. We were playing the Cubs and needed a sweep to help secure the holy grails of division and league championships. My seat was adjacent to Hero's girlfriend, which was next to his. I was keeping score, and she wanted to. Arriving in the third inning, she was about 12 outs behind. Offer, acceptance. She transferred the critical information to her scorecard, and that's how new best friends, no last names, came to be. To this day, he is my only best friend whose name I do not know. The first game started around 5:30 p.m. It was September, hot, and sold out. We were playing the Cubs, remember? I was in town to interview a man about a dog. I am not making this up. The bureau was low on travel funds, and the boss approved my travel request on the condition I would drive from Pine Bluff rather than fly. A day and a half of per diem was cheaper than round-trip airfare. The interview was scheduled to accommodate the doubleheader, as befits the meritorious accounts receivable of a grizzled veteran. So, like I said, it was hot, and beverages requiring a tax stamp were consumed. The Cardinals won the first game and then the second, and elation abounded. We, the Cardinals, were on our way. The game over, my new best friends remained to attend to administrative details while I took my leave. Everyone bidding everyone a cheery farewell, what with an early Christmas on site and visions of World Series hardware dancing in our heads. After walking down about two levels, the J. Edgar Hoover tick, a neurosis manifested by repetitive checking for the presence of one's FBI credentials securely ensconced on one's body in some clothing receptacle, timed in. Losing credentials was frowned upon by Mr. Hoover and others, and also by the administrative enforcer, Big Julie from Chicago. No credentials. Check, 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 check. Check all receptacles. No creds. I immediately retraced my steps, returning to my seat of the past 6 hours or so. En route going up, I met my new best friends coming down. Go Cards! Was pretty much the sum of our conversation in passing. At my, our, seat, a diligent search turned up peanut shells, beverage cups, and the assorted detritus expected of 18 human hours spent in one spot. The detritus did not include answered prayer. No creds. There was nothing for it but to return to my St. Louis motel digs. There was a question to answer and a strategy to craft. The question, to tell the bureau and face unpleasant consequences, or not to tell. Flout a bureau rule and possibly face unpleasanter consequences. Too much time spent as an undercover operative made plain the decision highway. Beg forgiveness. In the FBI family, agents of the genus Illegitimum non coborundum knew no bureau property had been lost until an FBI inspector could not find it. Remaining was to craft a strategy to persuade a man I had never seen I really was an FBI agent who did not, without admitting I could not, display any identification, to disregard that technicality and to answer my questions about a dog. Do not attempt this at home. Strategy crafted, question answered, sleep was interrupted by the motel's auto wake-up call. The morning's secular ablutions were interrupted by another call. The caller was my wife. She had received the strangest telephone call from a guy in St. Louis. In his possession were these FBI credentials displaying my name and picture. They appeared to be genuine. No, he responded to Lovely Life's query. LW's father was a retired FBI agent. She knew trouble when she heard it. No, he had not told anyone about having their credentials. Yes, they could be retrieved at his place of employment, the shoe department in a Dillard's on the far south side of St. Louis. Retrieve I did, prepared to kiss any shoe or body part. This untrained, supremely competent investigator had remembered from our ballgame visit I was from Arkansas. He had called the Little Rock FBI office and asked to speak to me on a matter, undisclosed, of some importance. No higher authority having yet come to work at that hour, the clerk on duty exercised his own very excellent judgment and patched the call to my home number. A trained investigator of many snows could not have done himself prouder. A product of Dillard's Shoe Department, that celebrated spawning ground of intrepid investigators since Cat's Paw found its soul, had saved my day.
Alone, Unarmed, and Unafraid, available online, is Taylor Eubanks' memoir of his time flying 200 unarmed combat missions in Southeast Asia. After 27 FBI years, he is now retired. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.